Why am I pausing as I say this? Maybe I should. So I am probably, so I'm going to be bold now, right? I am probably one of the most strategic people I know. I rarely say that out loud. Professionally, I wouldn't say that. So that's like, oh, I've just said that out loud. And that feels quite strange to say it out loud. It's something I say to other people, but I'm going to start saying it to myself. It's back myself. I'm going to start saying back myself more.
Welcome to Psychologically Speaking with me, Leela Ainge. And this season, we're exploring imposter phenomenon through the lens of risk-taking. We'll be hearing from women who have navigated who are seeking risk through their business activities. And the question I want you to sit with this season is this: do imposter experiences make us more aware of risk? And is that a good or a bad thing? To help us unpack this, today I'm joined by Rachel Cashman, a strategic advisor and facilitator known for helping leaders navigate trust, complexity, and difficult conversations in high stakes environments. Now, she's worked across government, healthcare, defence, and the life sciences. Rachel's path into this work is so fascinating, though, because she was born into a travelling circus in Australia and raised in Edinburgh. Her early experiences shaped a deep commitment to advocacy, integrity, and this brand of courageous leadership. From working in care settings and homeless shelters to advising national NHS programmes and briefing senior leaders, she has consistently centred on helping people face complexity with clarity and humanity. She's also the co-host of the Fearless Diversity podcast, which you have to go and listen to. She explores culture, psychological safety, one of the favourites on this podcast, leadership and the realities of navigating uncertainty in modern workplaces. Rachel, welcome to Psychologically Speaking.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
It's amazing to have you. And I think we just have to start with the circus. It's not very often I get to introduce a guest and say, and they were in a travelling circus. Who in your family had that circus background?
Contrary to popular belief, I wasn't a clown or an acrobat. But so my mum, in her 20s, was travelling around Australia. And one of the cheapest ways for her to do that was to get a job with Ashton's Travelling Circus as the teacher of the kids whose parents owned and ran the circus. And then she met my dad. Both of them have now passed away. I don't know him in adult life, but he was a horse trainer. He was the equine trainer. And then I was the kind of happy accident. All my baby photos are me with this particular elephant, Abu, that loved me. And so I've got an elephant tattoo on my ankle. And I have been known to whip my ankle out in sessions and talk about the elephant in the room. And
I love that so much.
If you ever see me popping my ankle on a table, it's not that I'm going mad. It's just that we need to orientate the group into what they're not talking about.
Well, I think there's something very special about having somebody on the guest for this season where we're revisiting imposter phenomenon to talk about whether we do or don't fit into spaces, have a sense of legitimacy. And I sense that we're going to get a lot of that from you. One of the things that I've asked all of my guests is to tell me a little bit about a risky situation they've been in their business. What is your risky thing that you want to talk to us about?
So I thought quite hard about what I would bring to this, because I professionally, and you'll know this dealing with psychological safety, a lot of my work is about helping teams align their attitude to risk and failure and mistake making. But I, as an individual, I've got a pretty high risk threshold. You know, when I went to college, I got on the bus in Edinburgh and ended up at the college at the end of the route and went, oh yes, it's time to go back into education. You know, so I'm quite instinctive. So I did think, oh gosh, what is my business risk? And I've settled on one, and I won't name the individual because I don't think that would be fair, but I turned down, and the market is difficult for small businesses right now. You know, that is well versed in the press. But at the beginning of last year, I turned down the opportunity to have a kind of between 60 and 80 grand contract that would have kept my business going for the year, taken off the kind of financial worries. Yeah. But my gut said no.
Ooh. So talk me through then how you work with your gut just generally in normal everyday life. You mentioned there I'm quite instinctive.
Yeah.
just describe your decision-making process to us.
So I am, in one sense, searingly strategic. And that is something I will always have a map, and I'm fast at that as well. And that's one of the things that sometimes, you know, my husband will be like, oh my word, how have we got here? You know, I'm also fast at assessing characters in a room and coming to not a fixed judgment, but getting a really good sense of what's going on. So, and I used to work in politics, so I've got all of that kind of, you know, the kind of how do you read a room, how do you work a room, all of that stuff going on. So that kind of sense plays into my gut. I also, you know, I was quite unconventional beyond the circus. I got expelled from school at 16. I always call myself a bit of a kind of a street fighter. Like, I'm pretty street aware, and I bring that into business. So that is also part of who I am, what I sit with. And if something just doesn't feel right, then I will listen to it. And in this instance, with this opportunity, I thought, I have got to go and just evidence my gut now. And so I went and I did my due diligence. And by due diligence, I don't mean just looking on Companies House or doing the kind of desktop stuff. I went through my networks. I found people. I road tested about this particular opportunity. And I know other people that have accepted opportunities with this particular individual and organization. And they're very content with it. I was not. And at the time, others in my network said, you're mad. And I was like, no, I'm right.
What was it? You say the content. I wasn't content with it.
So there were certain things about the particular organization's position on some public policy matters.
Okay.
There were certain things about, believe me, I'm all about, you know, the on my website, you know, you've got the Ruth Bader Ginsburg comment that, you know, you lead by taking people with you. So I am absolutely in a place of where people need to be able to disagree and divert. So yeah. It wasn't that I disagreed with them. It was more the manner with how they were campaigning and doing some stuff that I disagreed with. And some of the organizations where there are legitimate concerns about their leanings to, you know, that I had concerns with. And I just thought, for my brand, I need to be aware of that. You know, so I am a brand that talks to all. Working with an organization that's quite fixed in one, I need to be cognizant of that. So that was part of my due diligence.
Yeah.
The other part of my due diligence was about where they got their funding from and what they are networked in, they're involved in globally. Because it's dead easy when you're a small business and somebody says, you know, if you could do this short piece of work for us, help us deliver this. They wanted me to facilitate dialogue around something that was particularly contentious in the UK, last year. I was interested in doing that work, but I am discerning about who I do it for and how I do it. And I can't be bought, and I won't have my reputation either. So, and then I explored the individual and realized that they had some interesting encounters with the law in other countries. So, you know, so all my red flags were starting to go.
Yeah.
So, but it was based on my instinct, but I had to search for the evidence. It wasn't like it was easy to find. And when I worked in the NHS, I would always say to people, you know, you've got to triangulate your evidence. So, you know, talk to people, read stuff, and then go out and see for yourself. And that's what I did. So I absolutely trust my gut when it says, don't say yes, go and do your diligence. I also trust my gut when it says, do it, do it, do it. And I have to just then sense check myself. And I do the same process, but I will also go, whew, let's get excited if my gut says yes.
So what I'm hearing there is, you know, really a masterclass in risk scanning. And what you've done there is taken that feeling, that experience that says something's not quite right here, and you've scanned for risk. And that scan was quite a deep and strategic investigation of the facts and also opinions. You saw other people's opinions. I was very interested in that phrase you said, you know, I can't be bored. Where does that come from?
I'm very clear and believe it's important. So integrity is really important for me, and authenticity is really important for me. And in my work, I hold space for people in the way that you do, you know, hold. And I do a lot where I am holding space for people who are disagreeing quite vehemently about things. So it's really important that my integrity, and I have my own views and I'm happy to articulate my views, but they are mine and I will always defend them and I will always own them and I'm happy to share them. But equally, they may or may not have a place in a room that I'm facilitating. So I never hide from my views, but I'm very clear and authentic. They are mine. And I will not be bought by any organization that wants to pay me money to help promote their view or a view. And the thing about this type of advisory work and facilitation is it's very easy to slip into that where you're inadvertently promoting the agenda of somebody else if you don't have your own boundaries. So I'm really quite boundaried as well. Whilst I'm quite high risk appetite, I'm also quite boundaries. Though, as I say this to you, right, if my husband's not here, he's working in London today, but if he was here, he would be saying, the other thing that you need to know to counterbalance this about risk is that Rachel does not like surprises. So never give me a surprise birthday party. Never give me like a surprise like 50th or anything like 50 next year. Don't do it. Because I like to do the risk scanning thing. So I trust my gut, but I want to scan and then I want to decide. The other thing I do is shapeshift. So it's my husband calls it my shapeshifting, where on occasion, if I am perplexed, as a psychologist, you will probably have a very technical term for this, right? But in our house, she's off to the attic to shapeshift. So our bedroom's in the attic and I will so often just because it's all windows, so it feels like airy and space. And I will sometimes with a crime drama in the background, sometimes just absolute peace. And I just have to percolate what the conundrum is that's going on. And particularly if there's stuff about relationships and people. And so I did that in this instance as well. It was like, okay, what's the pros and cons? What's the counterfactual? Other people I know have just been like, yeah, we'll take the money. It's great. It won't come back to bite us. Well, I always worry about something coming back to bite me. So let's, you know, so I will just take time out to almost in my head shapeshift and place myself in all these different scenarios and then work out whose opinion do I care about? In each, like, if it goes wrong, who do I care about? A journalist once said to me, "You should, if somebody has an opinion on something you do, don't worry about it unless it's somebody that you love or respect. And if you love or respect them, then care to engage with them. But if it's not somebody that you love or respect, it's like tomorrow's chip paper. So in order for me to shapeshift, I also use that as part of my, and then I kind of emerge from the attic going, I've decided what I'm going to do now.
I love that. I think it would make a great blog series or podcast series, like, you know, Rachel's attic thinking or attic rumination. And you know, rumination is the psychological process that's going on there. And it's very interesting. I started off my season of the Reflection Room, which is my group coaching space this time around, with a session on rumination. And it's because I think women have been sold that overthinking is a really bad thing to do. It's very gendered, right? But rumination's one of the greatest skills that we have, and especially in this context of risk scanning, especially in that context of problem solving. And I wondered what your take on rumination is in terms of what you see play out in the facilitation space, because that must be really interesting.
Yeah. So I have myself in the shapeshifting, I can get into a negative rumination. So it's important to say that I just have to check myself on. And often that will be about the silliest things rather than the biggest things.
Yeah.
So if I am, I don't know, I'm giving up going to Weight Watchers or something like that, I'll ruminate it and I'll get really like, you know, kind of stress ruminated on about it. In the professional sense, it is very interesting, particularly watching leaders who are ruminating on their position. Everything I do is about human relationships and what plays out between people and how they allow themselves to either get stuck in rumination and therefore not be able to make a decision or not be able to advance the conversations they need to have? And what do I need to do, maybe with a chief executive or somebody in the team, to help them get unstuck from? When you see a group of people ruminating, oh my goodness. So that you go around, like, you know, if they, because it almost can become like a self-fulfilling prophecy in that instance, where nobody's prepared to say that, to call it out. Nobody's prepared to say we are going round the houses on this. So that I call it kind of the polite avoider culture, where everybody's comfortable ruminating, but not comfortable doing or deciding. And so I think we have to be really, really cautious in the team environment that we are allowing space for positive rumination and exploration. But the team has to be really aware of its own dynamics so that it doesn't slip into a kind of a negative rumination or being stuck in making decisions.
Yeah. And that really sits then. I mean, that echoes what we're seeing in the recent research on rumination. So we tend to think of it as having two elements. So there's the brooding side, which is what you were talking about there, when you get stuck and you get stuck in that negative loop. And then there is reflection. Reflection is rumination. And reflection, the difference I was saying to the reflection room is that reflection is very active because it opens us up to possibilities. And ultimately that is the role of, you know, a good facilitator, isn't it? Is to bring those opportunities out into the room.
Yeah, totally. I remember doing some work with a government department in the kind of legal work, like law, justice, kind of like a government arms length body. And we did a whole kind of reflection thing. And I was, and they came out and they went, "We feel liberated at the end of this." It was so funny watching people who had a very kind of straitjacketed, kind of conformist type of role, necessary role, allowing them to feel liberated from through the process of reflection or positive rumination. And a lot of the things I kind of encourage is that through curiosity. So, you know, when I work with teams, it's like, let's have some curiosity, let's have some empathy, let's have some humility, and let's not believe we've got all the answers. So how can we harness the kind of collective stuff that's going on between us? And that can be great, great fun as well to see people.
Yeah, it's really playful, really playful. And, you know, that's a really good kind of flex as well, because when we get into brooding, it does center us in our own heads, and we often think of brooding as being a "why me? Why is this happening to me?" Whereas that reflection moves you into the "what next?" And the "what next" is that possibility and everything that with it. It's such a fascinating area, isn't it? I want to go back because there was something else that you've touched on that I thought was so psychologically interesting, just the phrasing that you've used, because you've said a few times, you know, it's my gut. And I don't know, I hear women use gut instinct quite a lot. Let me ask you the question. Why do you think we think about our gut instinct? What is it about the emotion of our gut?
Gosh, do you know, and I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but I also get bad migraines. And I looked up something on the internet the other week because I could feel it in my gut. And there's a medical thing called a gut migraine.
Okay.
Which I hadn't heard of before, which was where essentially, like, I was just getting these really, really bad cramps. I'm going to have to go to the doctor and look at it. But it was linked, and there's some new research apparently about the gut-brain connection.
Yeah.
And the kind of spasming of your tummy almost having the same physical effect as a head migraine, but in your stomach. I thought that was like such a brilliant like analogy. So I'm going to go off and search a little bit more about it, and if I can find it, I'll send it to you so
please
you can
do.
Share it. But for me, it is a very physical feeling. So the example I gave you about my decision and my risk, I can feel it in my stomach. Like it's like a weight almost in my stomach. Like I can feel the weight, and it's not a bad weight. It's just that I get this sense, and then almost like an inner core thing where I just go, that's what I've got to do. Now I need to prove it or disprove it. And it is, so it's like it starts in the gut, and then it's like an inner core, like people can't see, but I'm zipping myself up physically, you know, and it kind of like, you know, and it zips up into the brain where I go. So that's how I would describe it. And if I don't get that sense at all about something. So when I met you for the first time, I had it sat on the Teams meeting with you. I was like, yeah, I can work. This is great. This will get on, because I had that sense. And it was just, you know, and it wasn't overt. It was just there. And if I hadn't had it, I would have been like, oh, maybe this will work. Let me think about that. And I might have had to shapeshift a wee bit to, you know, work through. But it's that almost automatic. It's like an autopilot thing. So I really don't like woo-woo stuff. So I, even as I'm talking now, I'm finding myself going, oh my God, where am I going? But as I think I've got older, because I've learned to trust it more, because it served me well, I have been able, I think, to almost embrace more that feeling, trusting the bodily sensations about when the gut's talking to me. Does that sound mad?
No, it doesn't. And I'm reflecting on a conversation I had in the last season with Kendall Marie Platt. And she's a horticultural therapist.
Yes. I follow her on the Insta.
Yeah. And she kind of talked about this idea that we kind of learn to ignore our bodily sensations. So that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Mm.
The thing that I was kind of sitting with as you were explaining my gut process here, was actually everything that you backed it up with was just like pure hard experience. So your political background, your experience of scanning for risk, your, you know, those decades of experience you'll have behind you. That was the bit that I was like, isn't it interesting that you are giving your gut the responsibility for that when actually it's probably an even process, right?
Yeah.
More experience has led to that bodily reaction, but that experience is almost downplayed because we kind of go, oh, it's just a feeling. But it isn't. It's a very calculated, strategic feeling that you had because you've got the experience.
Leading us great into imposter syndrome.
Exactly.
But it is interesting because why am I pausing as I say this? Maybe I should. So I'm going to be bold now, right? I am probably one of the most strategic people I know. I rarely say that out loud, other than when I've had too many drinks and I'm kind of ranting about somebody else doing something wrong at home. And I'll be like, why didn't they do this? You know, I'm the most strategic person I know and I would do that. But professionally, I wouldn't say that. So that's like, oh, I've just said that out loud. And that feels quite strange to say it out loud. But I have worked in multiple sectors at the most senior levels, having to negotiate some very, 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 very tricky stuff. I read people really well and can predict their reactions. So you're absolutely right. What is it that makes me less comfortable about owning that alongside owning my gut instinct? And I think that as I'm saying this out loud, so I've not come to this conversation with any preconceived, you know, thoughts. I think it's because I own my gut.
Ooh.
And so I have the opinion on it. If I was to use all that other stuff, what happens if somebody went, oh, you're a bit rubbish at that job, actually. So I don't know why you were relying on, you know, your political background, for example, because I thought you were a bit rubbish there. But if you give the success factor to your own physical body, it's the one thing that you actually do own that nobody else does.
Oh, that's really insightful, isn't it? That's interesting that, you know, I'm going to come from a place that somebody else can't challenge.
Mm.
It's wholly and truly me. So let me ask you then about imposter phenomenon. So my research, which I did with entrepreneurs during lockdown, kind of led us to this place where we were seeing imposter not as something that's wrong with the individual, but it's very much a symptom or a contextual thing. It's an experience. So if I was to ask you, what imposter experiences have you had that you could share with our audience today and the listeners? You know, what could you tell them and say, you know, this has happened to me?
I'm not sure if this is imposter, because I'll go with the first one that came to mind, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is imposter experience or if it's the conditions that have created to make me feel like an imposter. So I worked for a large pharmaceutical company. So over the decades, I've worked in politics, Westminster, Whitehall, trade unions and the private sector. So I was working for a large pharmaceutical company and I was seconded into the Department of Health. And I was seconded in, just to give some context here, I was the first person in the country to, for all of the companies across the kind of competing industry, to sign a joint agreement to say they would provide me with commercial data, research data, to do this project, right? And they all signed this agreement. So that should be quite a trusted You know, mm-hmm. I should have been quite confident in that, right? Here's a sign, here's a symbol. So going to one of my very first meetings in the Department of Health with the civil service, and there are brilliant, brilliant civil servants in the Department of Health. But this particular meeting, I remember going into the basement, going to the meeting room, the door was locked. So I'm rattling the door handle and I couldn't get in. And I thought, oh, why? And then this official opened the door and I went, I meant to be in here. And they went, you're not one of us. And the door shut and it locked again. No. And I was in the corridor.
They literally said that inner fear out loud. You're not one of us.
Yeah. Amazing, right? And I actually went on to work with those individuals really, really well thereafter. But it was a kind of like, I actually have no place here. That is what it said. Yeah.
And I think this is it. So one of the things that we've talked about this week in the reflection room is this sense of legitimacy, when we feel legitimate and when we don't. So I've updated my imposter phenomenon workshop recently, and every year I pick a different theme. And we went with legitimacy because I said, actually, if it come down to it, who am I to be here? Mm. Am I one of you or not? And it is, from a social psychology perspective, it's all about social identity. It's about groups and whether we're in the in crowd or not, you know, to talk about playground behaviour. But even in adulthood, it's that, are you in or are you out?
Mm. Well, do you know what? You've just reminded me of a thing I did a couple of years ago now. And I'm dead comfy public speaking. I've been doing it my whole life. I quite enjoy it. But I don't get booked to do that many public talks at corporate gigs and stuff. And I never quite understand why. And I do. It's because I don't put myself out enough as a speaker. Mm-hmm. But I did one and a conference for this organization, and the speaker before me, and if he ever listens to your podcast, I'm sorry if he gets offended, but never mind. But the Matthew Syed, who wrote the guy who wrote the books about the thingy thinking book and writes for the Times newspaper and things, he was on before me, and I missed it because of transport. I was late. Like, I didn't get to hear his contribution, but he was on before me, and I thought, oh, flipping heck, I've got to follow him. This is going to be like, so I get on stage and I do my thing. It was on psychological safety, actually. Do my thing, goes down really well. And there was a queue of people afterwards. And I always do get lots of people come and talk to me after if I speak. And everybody went, you are a much better speaker than Matthew Syed. And they got on their feedback, they got I scored higher than he did. Now, I'm telling you what, I certainly wasn't charging the tens of thousands of pounds I'm sure he was. And it really rammed home to me, like, how are these people? And I'm not knocking what he does. I'm, brilliant. I like quite a lot of what he does. But I was like, how is he? We're literally on the same event. He was on at 2 o'clock. I was on at 2:30. And he has probably commanded a speaker fee of tens of thousands more than I got, because my mindset going into it was, that's nice, they've asked me to speak, as opposed to, do you know what? I have got a lot to bring to this stage. All that experience that you talked about before.
Yeah. And it is, isn't it? It's that it's kind of when we are able to sit and very rationally say, yeah, I've got experience. I am legitimate. I am in this room. I'm going to be on that stage. But there's something else there as well, which is that how we reward presence and, popularity, big speakers and popular speakers and people who've got a big name or following through print or whatever, they're going to command a gravitas. And so as an organiser, they're like kind of on this, to use a circus analogy, this tightrope as well, because they want to bring in a big name. But actually, I've been to, and there's been like some big names that have been sold out. And then I've been in a small kind of tent, and it's been so engaging you actually get to hear somebody who's not polished and they're not over rehearsed. And that's, I love storytelling. So anyone who's not so polished, I really love. And I've had to say to people who've wanted to come onto the podcast before, don't come with a rehearsed story. Think about it, but then let's just explore it, because a conversation is so much more interesting, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, so I might have to like come in and re-edit myself here. But so this is a scientific experiment, and people were given information and they were acting as correspondents. And it isn't necessarily the people who are most well-versed or most well-understood scientifically who are seen as the most legitimate or the most trustworthy.
Hi, it's Leela. So the paper I was trying to remember badly in this conversation is called Looking into Crystal Balls, a Laboratory Experiment on Reputational Cheap Talk. And it was by Maloso, Nanari and Ottavani. So these researchers asked people to act as expert correspondents, making predictions. And then other people got to judge how credible they seemed. What they found was really fascinating because the evaluators were rewarding confidence and certainty more than honesty or nuance. So in other words, people who sounded sure of themselves were often perceived as more legitimate, even when they weren't necessarily more accurate. And I think this links to what Rachel was describing, because we don't just judge expertise based on knowledge. We judge it through delivery and confidence and fluency and whether somebody feels believable to us. That was the research paper that my menopausal brain was trying to remember.
It's really important, I think. And I said at the top of this conversation, like, authenticity is really important for me. Yeah. And I have kind of learned over the years, and I genuinely think something does happen when you, like, as a woman, when you hit menopause, where you do start to kind of, it's not that you don't care as much, but your frame of reference, because I have had a surgical menopause, so I went into menopause very quickly, and it did kind of almost happen overnight, which is another thing that made me look at my kind of mind body, like, yeah, what is going on here. There is something about, for me, about that authenticity. So I don't need to like somebody to enjoy their company or to be fascinated by them. If they're real, and it comes, your thing about not being too polished, like, yeah, you know, if people have too much that they are just trying to present what they think people want to hear, I can't bear it. I also have a loud face, right? So I am not very good at the poker face. So I will be sat there sometimes and I'll be like, oh God, and I have to check my face in, yeah, because I've got a loud face if I think somebody is being really inauthentic.
But also the critical side of me is going, yeah, I can sit there and I can say I don't like people who are too polished, but then I have to. It's that empathic thinking again, isn't it? The compassion. Yeah. I have to put myself into the shoes of anybody who puts themselves forward to speak or be on a podcast. And if you are nervous, or if something matters to you, if it's meaningful, you're going to practice it. And we can get ourselves into positions where maybe we aren't authentic, not because we're not authentic,
yeah,
but we present as inauthentic because it matters to us. So, you know, I think we have to give ourselves and others that compassion, but it is so difficult because we're all just receiving these signals all the time. And as you said, you know, I've got a way to kind of strategically understand and sift my world and scan it for risk. Yeah. And actually part of that is some of it is looking for inauthenticity, because that's worked well for me in the past and it is continuing to work well for, yeah, me. I mean, last year you would have taken on a business opportunity that perhaps wouldn't have ended well for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that compassion point you make is really important. I think there's a difference between practice and polish, you know, where you've got you're kind of seasoned, you know, when people like get on stages and they trot out the same slide deck and they, yeah, kind of, they do it in a very, this is my shtick kind of way. And I think that is radically different from people who may appear in a particular lens because they're trying to do a good job, as, yeah, opposed to, you know, they're not masking, not intentionally masking who they really are or how they really feel or what the elements of their personality. And it's a bit like, I can't really bear the phrase, bring your whole self to work. And I work with, you know, when I work with teams, I say this quite a lot, because you don't want to see the whole of myself. You want to see an authentic version of me. So I can still rock up and talk about the fact that I am married to a man whose first wife died. I've got two stepchildren who have historic trauma in their lives that comes with complexity, right? So I will reference that. I don't need to detail it. I'm not bringing it all into what I do. But it means if you work with me, and there have been clients that have worked with me in the past where I've had to say, do you know what, this, I have stuff going on because of this. And so therefore, you know, I need us to have a flexible arrangement during this period of time, or I need us to do this. So it's understanding how you on who you bring to a professional environment in a way that keeps you safe as well as making you real.
What I'm taking from that then, and from this psychological safety angle, is, you know, whole self may not be psychologically safe. It may not be the best strategy. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think people, when I work with, particularly with chief executives, and I'm working with them on how can they still be vulnerable, still show that vulnerability without leaving themselves open, which is what they, you know, don't want to be. They don't want to. And sometimes there is an assumption that they have to bring their whole selves, they have to bring every part, they have to share every part of their life, because otherwise they're not being vulnerable or they're not being real. I will often say to them, what are the parts of your life that you're comfortable anywhere? So what I've just told you about my family situation, it could appear on the front of a newspaper tomorrow. My family would be fine with it. I'd be fine with it. You know, everybody's, it's real. It is, you don't have all the details of it, but we're happy to share it. So it's having my discernment. I love that word, right? It's like having a bit of discernment about the context that you're in and how you dial up or down. I'm doing it for anybody listening. I'm doing like the dimmer switch lights, you know, I'm doing actions here, you know, but you know, we've got those light switches that you can, like the dimmer switches, how you, so it's not hiding who you are, but it's just recognizing when is it right for you and the others and the environment to dial it up, and when's it right to like dial it down.
Dial it back down. And there's a really interesting link back to imposter phenomenon here. So one of the findings, certainly for women and entrepreneurs who were in online spaces, so social media, online communities, Facebook, LinkedIn, there's this idea of context collapse. And you just mentioned the word context there. And it made me think, actually, that's what that is all about. That discernment of control of what do I put out there and who gets to see it? Who gets to judge me? How do I get to do that self-presentation, you know, that psychological process of how do I hold back what I need to hold back and how do I control what I put out there? And there seems to be a lot of conflicting advice for women in particular about, you know, like you say, you will see a lot of advice to put your whole self out there, be authentic. But people struggle with what does authenticity mean? Yeah. They struggle with how do I tell people about my life when I'm quite a private person? And then sitting underneath all of this, of course, is the fact that, you know, anything that we put out there could be, you know, legitimately in this connected world, be seen or judged or harshly criticized by other people. So it is really challenging. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. And you have to really think about the, you know, I was once taught back in my political days, and at that point we had BlackBerries and we didn't have, you know, Facebook wasn't even a thing and we hadn't, you know, but I was once taught that, you know, anything you write down anywhere, you have to be comfortable with that appearing on the front of a national newspaper. And I have lived by that. Now, people have held me account for things they dislike that I've said, that I put on my social media, or, you know, I have no doubt that I will have lost clients because I might have put something on X or on LinkedIn or Instagram or something that people disagree with or they don't like. Because equally, we do live in a country that's a democracy and free speech is important and people have the right to have opinions. And that's, you know, that's civilized, you know, living in a civilized democracy. But I do not put anything ever, ever in writing that I would not be content to be on the front of a newspaper or stand up in court and defend.
That's
I might think it, but I won't put it out because you can't control it. Once you've hit send, you can't control it. And I learned my lesson on this really badly as well, because I once, when I was working in the pharmaceutical industry again, it was a big negotiation on, I think it was like the price of a medicine or something. And I had, it was a really senior man. And I wrote, I think it was a Friday, and I can see myself in the office now writing it. And I basically said, I can't believe he has said X. He shouldn't have been in the room. He's possibly screwed that negotiation, something along that line.
Oof.
And he was way more senior than me. And instead of sending it to, I think I was going to send it to my boss, I sent it to him. Immediately was like, oh my, I had to go to the pub that night. I was like, oh God, this. But in the moment, what can you do, right? You've got to own it. So I immediately emailed him about that and said, obviously that wasn't meant for you, but I've possibly, you know, phrased this inappropriately, but it is entirely what I think. The strategy was wrong. You shouldn't have been in the room.
Yeah. What happened? What happened?
Oh, he was fine in the end. Yeah, he was fine. He was fine because if I'd sent it and not addressed it, he would have. I probably wouldn't have been fine. But because I'd owned it, and that, so accountability for me is really important. So anything I put in writing, I'm happy for it to be on. Not happy, but you know, it could get on the front of a newspaper. I could be in court defending it. I'm fine with that.
Oh, I love that. Do you know, you're making me think at the moment about something that I'm sitting with at the moment. So I spend most of my weeks researching and doing research for other people for their thought leadership. And they produce wonderful stuff with it, and they get bits in papers and magazines. And, you know, that's the bit I love about my work, is that I can go and find the most nuanced bit of information that somebody can turn into something wonderful. And for about a year, I keep saying, do you know, I'm going to pitch and I'm going to write some stuff, because I do have a Substack blog and I blog. Okay. And I keep thinking, yeah, I should pitch, but I don't. I don't pitch to write things. And I think it is, as you're saying, you know, worked in politics. So I spent time working at Westminster Council in my early years. And then I've worked with police forces and in local government and pharmaceutical and engineering. And, you know, all these places where there are a lot of corporate rules and litigation around what you can and you can't say. And I've been in a couple of posts where I've been in a politically neutral post. And for anyone who doesn't know, you literally cannot have a political opinion in public spaces when you're in a politically neutral post. You have to be seen as politically agnostic to your superiors. So I have learned to be quite, what I would say, vanilla in what I say. And I even catch myself doing it now. It's like, well, I have to look at the other side, you know, and I try to be very level in everything that I'm saying and weigh things up. And there's some incredible learning and relearning that's going on as a psychologist to really allow that critical part of my head to really dig deep and go, no, that's not right. And so, you know, that comes out for me through things like feminism and really going into, this isn't right, this isn't structurally okay, and this is unfair. But there's definitely then possibly something about my own imposter experiences, which is, who am I to have an opinion on that when I've spent so long actually probably having this kind of masking in front of my opinion, because it served me really, really well at one point in my career. I guess what? I'm not in that part of my career anymore. I can say what I want.
But it's about how you've, what you've got used to, right? And how you can actually step out of that box and into something different, and take from that box what you need and will continue to serve you well, and then explore new things. And I think there's a flexibility that you have to have with it. So I was National Women's Officer and Head of Equalities for one political party, worked off in the civil service, as I say, later on in my career, for ministers who were from a different political party. I just never hid who I was in previous. Yeah. So people say to me, oh, how are you going to get on with the Secretary of State when he's, you know, this one? And I was like, well, you know, we're all adults. I'm entitled to have worked for an opposing political party in the past. But in this job now, as an official at the Department of Health, you know, in this job, I am politically neutral. I mean, I didn't have to be, but it was astute for me to be. So I was at NHS England, I didn't have to be. At the Department of Health, I did have to be. But, you know, I was able to have that kind of dexterity, if you like, to say, okay, well, I can stop now. And that's also, you have to be a bit disciplined about that. So during that period, I would say, well, out of respect to my employer and me and my role, I will dial it right down. I won't put anything out. I won't leave the role, change that. I can choose to dial it up again. And if I then got another politically restricted role in the future, I would very contentedly dial it down again. Yeah.
That's so fascinating. I think perhaps there's something there about feminism. And, you know, if we think about how gendered expectations with women do expect us sometimes to be quiet and to be softer in our delivery, definitely to be more compassionate as a gendered role. If we saw that as a dial, perhaps it wouldn't feel so difficult to perform those roles where we go, I'm dialing up my opinion here. I'm dialing up my presence. I'm dialing up my volume. because it serves me here. And actually knowing that it is a flexible thing, it's not a, you have to trade off. Yeah. And we do that, don't we, in our own heads? Like we do these trade-off thinkings all the time because it's cognitively, you know, saves time for us. But it trips us up because we get stuck between being all of one thing or all of nothing.
I know people dislike me because I have articulated my opinions on feminism, because I always have considered myself a feminist, and other things. So I know I've not been invited to certain professional parties, you know, do's, like Christmas do's and things, because I'm kind of, maybe they'll think, oh, she can't quite be, it's not that I can't quite be trusted, but oh, she's opinionated. So, you know, and I that's fine. If you can't handle it, then that's your stuff. That's not me, because I'm not unkind. I'm not, you know, don't break the law, not unkind. Respect other people, respect, you know, this is, everything is always a kind of a working alliance, if you like. But as a woman who was born in a circus, lived in a caravan, was on free school meals, you know, I am entitled to have a view about how society structurally helped me or disadvantaged me over the years. But not everybody likes women who have the ability to articulate it.
I think you're so right there. I want to ask you a little bit about your experience with the homelessness sector, because when I was working at Bolton Council, we worked with the Prince's Trust for a while. And we used to take people who were experiencing or were at risk of homelessness in on work experience. And I got to manage that in Bolton Council, in the place where I was working. And I enjoyed it so much that I actually went to go and work for that charity just for a short period. So it was almost like a career sabbatical for me. I went and worked and helped create relationships with corporates who would, you know, then get people in. I found that quite a demanding role. I was working directly with what we call service users at the time. I wouldn't say that now, I don't think. It taught me so much, but it was so all-encompassing. It wasn't a job I could do forever. But how did you come to work with the homelessness sector and people, I suppose? And what have you taken from it?
I loved it. There's two jobs I had way back in my early career that I still, funnily enough, I was out for dinner the other night and somebody said, oh, when you talk about those jobs, you still kind of light up a little bit. One was at the homeless shelter and the other was in care of the elderly and dementia care. In the homeless job, it was, so I was in Edinburgh and kind of Greyfriars Bobby and round the kind of old town of Edinburgh. And there's a kind of a associated with the church where the Greyfriars Bobby statue is, the Grass Market area. There's an information centre, like a drop-in centre that was for people to be able to brush their teeth, get benefits advice or, you know, and it was just, I just loved the sense of opportunity. It was obviously very difficult for at that point in time, most of the people that I was working with were older men. There was not as many young and not as many women, and the actual configuration of people that were living on the streets in Edinburgh at that time was slightly different, I think, from what you have today. But there was a real community feel about them. So I would go into town on a Saturday and they would all be saying, hi, Rachel, how are you? And we'd have a little chat as you go in. And I just found it very rewarding is the wrong word. It was rewarding. But for me, it was just, they were fascinating individuals, right? Every single person that I worked with in that environment had a story about their life, not just about how they ended up being in the situation they were in, but who they were and what they brought into the world. And what I think is often missing now, even, you know, when we talk about, so I live in Brighton now, which is a really high homeless population. We forget that these are people with a story and relationships and just stuff that's happened to them that is of value, that is of interest, that can contribute to the world that we all share. And so I found that work, I just loved it. I just loved but it was a really early lesson for me in what you're there to do and achieve, because you can't always achieve positive outcomes for people. And so learning to say goodbye, learning to let go. I'm not very good with goodbyes, but learning to say, you know, say goodbye, learning to let go, learning to understand the limits of your own proficiency, but the limits of your own capability as well.
I asked you about the risk approach and processes that you employ. And you talked to us about a risky situation last year. You talked to us about your gut driving that. But actually, I think what unfolded was that you are noticing your bodily emotions based on all of your experience and all of that risk scanning and strategy and all the stuff that you really value coming into the fore. And when I said that, you know, imposter and risk have these really symbiotic relationships, it's the idea that when we are aware of imposter experiences, when we've had them, when people have literally shut the door and have said, you're not one of us, we scan for risk in a different way. And how helpful that scanning has been for you in your career. And I wonder, you know, how does that land for you with me kind of summarizing it in that way?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because you kind of reflect on your life and you think, well, I've just bobbed along. I've just done. Do you know what I mean? Like I've gone from this to this. But what you've kind of set out, you've got like a synopsis of my kind of professional approach there, which I think is really valid. And I have taken, I mean, I've loved having a chat, obviously. Lovely. But I have taken from this, and it's something I say to other people, but I'm going to start saying it to myself, is back myself. I'm going to start saying back myself more in that sense of the kind of not being afraid to just back myself to be out there.
You've got the receipts, is what they would say. That's the popular phrase at the moment, isn't it? You've got the receipts. You know what you're doing.
You
are in the room.
And I just need to, I think, sometimes be a bit more bold about that. And even though I'm quite direct, and even though I am and appear quite confident, that doesn't always necessarily equate to being bold in what you want to do. So I'm going to back myself to be a bit bolder. Thanks.
I am going to drop in all of the links to your website, your podcast, everything onto the show notes. I'm going to urge everybody to go and check you out because you are fascinating. I think even just this like kind of dip into your experience just goes to show how much you have to offer organisations, and I love your perspective. Thank you so much for being the first guest on this season. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you for having me. See you soon.
What a fabulous conversation that was with Rachel. I'm sure you'll agree. I want you to know that I have a free challenge in the Reflection Room this week, and you can join it by heading to my website, which is www.leelaange.co.uk. There's an announcement bar at the top. Click on there and you get access to the Reflection Room. I've set out 5 days worth of challenges to help you move through your hard thing. So if you are putting something off, or if you've got something challenging in your business right now, this is the place that you want to be. Head to my website, sign up, and I can't wait to welcome you into the Reflection Room. That's all for now. Bye.